Manchester City has one foot in Champions League's Final Eight, while Arsenal face the realities of one of the best teams of its generation. In Europa, we look forward to United, Liverpool, and Spurs' chances to help UEFA's coefficient, while the season's first piece of silverware will be handed out on Sunday. Welcome, everybody, to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. Nipun Chopra is going to join me in the second half of the show to preview the coming weekend in England. But right now, I want to welcome in Kartik Krishnayar to talk about the Champions League week that was. And Kartik, let's start with the game that just finished a few hours ago, Manchester City's 3-1 victory in Kiev over Dinamo. Manuel Pellegrini got a surprising amount of flack in the English press and among some Manchester City fans for fielding a second or third choice team on Sunday in the FA Cup. Does this result at all vindicate his decision?
Yes. There was a lot of flack from the English media, the romantics about the FA Cup, just a lot of negativity. I actually applauded the decision, saying I wish Pellegrini had learned to do this a couple years ago and rotate his squad in the cup competitions. Because if you look at the League Cup, and obviously Manchester City are in the final on Sunday, consistently Pellegrini has picked his top side, his top players, or something close to his first team in the League Cup, even against lower division opposition. And then the same thing in the FA Cup last season against Sheffield Wednesday and then against Middlesbrough. We were eliminated by Middlesbrough, but he played a first-choice side. So this is the first time he's really kind of taken advantage of the cup competitions the way Roberto Mancini did to rotate his squad. And it was essential because Jesus Navas is injured. Kevin De Bruyne is injured. Samir Nasri is injured. And on and on and on. Manchester City just don't have that many fit senior players. There are a lot of youngsters that could fill roles, but we saw that some of those guys aren't ready on Sunday. So that decision is vindicated. He still has the ability to rotate his fullbacks, and that's about it. No other first players can be rotated. Even the goalkeeper, we saw Caballero come up in a couple errors on Sunday. So he had to hold the guys like Aguero and Silva and Sterling and Yaya Toure, those four guys, and Fernandinho, those five guys in particular, who absolutely positively are going to have to play because there's no one backing them up that can play right now, senior player. And he had to hold those five guys out at a minimum, and he held all five of them out. And I think all five guys played pretty well today.
It seemed to really pay off. I think a lot of people thought Manchester City were the better team here, but it was a long trip from Manchester to Kiev. It's obviously a road game in Champions League against very talented opposition. And even though Kiev hasn't played a match in 2.5 months because of Ukraine's long winter break, I think people expected more of a challenge in this one. And at the beginning of the match, it looked like Dinamo Kiev was going to put up that challenge, but a 3-1 scoreline looks very impressive, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Manchester City, with a home game coming in a couple weeks, does have one foot in a very rare round of eight appearance in Champions League.
Right, it would be the first time in club history a round of eight appearance in the UEFA Cup under Mark Hughes. Six or seven seasons ago now, but this is the high water mark in Europe for Manchester City potentially since winning the Cup Winners' Cup back in 1970, coming off of an FA Cup win in 1969 over Leicester City, the famous game where Neil Young scored the winning goal. So it's a historic victory for Manchester City, and it was, again, very telling about Manchester City. I think that there's an emphasis on Europe this season. We've seen Manchester City's best performances have been in Europe this season. However, it was still uneven. Very good in the first half. I thought Silva and Sterling in particular looked better than they've looked in weeks, maybe months, yeah. In the case of Silva. Sterling has had a couple of nice games mixed in there with a lot of indifferent games. But both were really good in the first half.
The goal they teamed up on was a very well-executed goal from Aguero to Sterling to Silva. Sterling's ability to kind of see past four defenders in that line to know that Silva was making that run. And the distance of that run for Silva, too, just a really well-worked goal.
But then in the second half, we saw some of the same defensive frailties that we've seen before. Fernando sometimes out of position. Yaya Toure not tracking back. Otamendi overcommitting defensively. He overcommits a lot. And the fullbacks not always on it. Clichy getting beaten. He had a tough assignment, right? Yarmolenko is one of the best wide players in Europe. So that was a difficult one for Clichy particularly. But again, Yarmolenko is coming off a winter break. So yeah. He wasn't as sharp today as he might be in that second leg. So it was important to get not just Yarmolenko, but the whole Dynamo Kiev side. So it was important to get the first leg result that Manchester City got.
You mentioned it a little bit. I think we have to talk about how the squad will change between now and Sunday. We're going to talk about the League Cup final in depth in the second half of the show. But Manchester City's lack of depth on the bench, we saw from the team that was named today, really the only regulars that were healthy enough to make this trip were backup fullbacks. It's even deceiving to call them backup fullbacks, kind of co-starters, Pablo Zabaleta, Alexander Kolarov. I guess we would expect them to come into the starting 11 this weekend. The only other option to rotate into the team will be Kalichi Iheanacho, and that would entail a formation change probably, or just purely dropping Sergio Aguero. How do you think this short turnaround, even though Liverpool has a short turnaround too, they don't have to travel, they're against lesser opposition, how do you think this short turnaround is going to affect Manchester City's prospects on Sunday?
Well, I think it's going to be the same side, with the exception of the two fullbacks. And probably you'll see, you know what, it depends whether you'll see Clichy or Kolarov, because I think there's a real concern about Kolarov's defensive ability. Pellegrini has had that concern, and if he feels like whoever's playing on the right side for Liverpool, and we don't know what kind of formation Klopp's going to play, who he's going to throw out there, if he's concerned about that player, he's going to put Clichy there. Clichy played today because I think the decision was made that Kolarov can't mark Yarmolenko, right? I mean, and that's an accurate description, right? He's not Kolarov is a wing back, right? He's a guy who's been shoehorned into a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, whatever four back formation team that Manchester City's played since he's been in England the last 6 years. But at Lazio, he was always a wing back. And I think if he were to go back to Serie A, he'd be playing let's say he went to Lazio's rivals. Let's say Spalletti brought him to Roma. I could see him just playing left wing back. I don't think he's ever been that kind of left fullback against a really good attacking winger you want. So Clichy might end up starting that game also. But I think, Sanya and Zabaleta will rotate. And I would expect those two to rotate for a while now, given the fixture congestion Manchester City has. So this happened to be Sanya's date. So I would say Zabaleta against Liverpool in the final, then back to Sanya against in the league, which is the following Wednesday. Other than that, there's no rotation coming. I don't think you would be tempted to drop Sterling or Silva and put Iheanacho in a 4-4-2 if those two guys hadn't both looked so good today. Because Pellegrini has done that at times in this period where City has had this very thin squad, where he's gone from 4-2-3-1, which is the default formation, dropped him. It would either be Silva or Sterling, and then put in Iheanacho up top next to Aguero. But both those guys coming off good games, I think he will probably play them both, and then maybe Silva doesn't play in the league game against Liverpool and Anfield on Wednesday, and then you switch to the 4-4-2. Or maybe Manchester City have another player or two available by then. It looks like Jesus Navas will be back at some point in the next few weeks, and Kevin De Bruyne should be back at the beginning of April. So if Manchester City can stay in these competitions, stay in Europe until then, and stay within sight of the top three in the Premier League, it's possible that the season may not be lost. However, it is at this point looking like if Manchester City don't win Sunday, it will be a trophyless season. That's just the feeling, especially with the manager change coming, with Pellegrini leaving and Pep coming in, and then all these injuries.
One more match on Wednesday, probably a predictable result, Atletico Madrid at PSV Eindhoven, finishing 0-0. The twist here is that PSV played the last 30 minutes of this match down 10 men, as is Atletico gets a decent result, goes home to the Vicente Calderon for the second leg, where they'll be favored there. Tuesday's results had the marquee matchup of the week, the defending champions in this tournament, the emerging clear favorites in this tournament, Barcelona at Arsenal. We talked about this matchup a lot this weekend, Kartik. You and I talked about it. Lawrence and I talked about it. Talked about whether we were not giving Arsenal enough of a chance in this one. They end up losing 2-0. And I think as a testament to Barcelona, it can be said that Arsenal didn't play that bad, but Barcelona is just really damn good.
Yeah, I think the difference is that this is going to sound very silly and like the simplest analysis you've heard on the show in 10 years, since we've been on here 10 years. Barcelona just has better players. I can't pin anything Arsenal did wrong in this match other than that counterattacking goal and perhaps a couple guys being out of position. We can get to that in a minute. But you think about the chance that falls to the Ox, to Oxlade-Chamberlain. If Arsenal had a better player highly priced player in that position. You know, the kind of players that Manchester City, Chelsea, and Man United seem to buy every year. City less so recently, but the kind of players Manchester United are buying constantly. They probably score there. And a couple of the other opportunities you could point out, saying, well, maybe if Arsenal had better players, they would have been they would have been fine. I don't think they played that poorly. The one player I do think did not have a good game was Mesut Ozil, and that's very disappointing. This was a great opportunity for him, former Real Madrid player, a guy who's on the cusp of being a world-class player, and it seems like he's been on the cusp of being a world-class player since he left Werder Bremen to join Real Madrid in 2010, but he's never quite gotten there. This could have been a match at home at the Emirates where he asserted himself into that conversation, and he just wasn't very good. But and the other player that was very disappointing, obviously, was Murder Soccer. One quick note. Coughlin was taken off for Flamini, and I felt bad for Flamini. He gave up that penalty being a mistake by Murder Soccer. But we have to assume Coughlin cannot go 90 minutes just yet at this level of intensity, because otherwise there's absolutely no reason to pull that guy off. Mm-hmm. He was having a very good game.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and how that'll affect this weekend when Manchester United welcomes Arsenal at Old Trafford. Maybe that's something to watch too. Manchester United, another team that has the potential to dominate possession, although Arsenal can put up a bigger fight at Old Trafford.
Although Wenger probably felt like he needs, if he has to go 90 minutes in one of those games, Coughlin, you're going to want him against Manchester United.
Yeah,
for sure.
Potentially. Let's talk about that counter-attacking goal, Kartik, because as you were mentioning it, I do think that's just a great example of the very small margin of error teams have against Barcelona. We saw Luis Suarez really get that counterattack into motion, but rather than playing that ball across to Neymar at his first chance, he waited for the defender to close him out on the sideline and then play the ball between his legs. And then Neymar, rather than hitting it over to Messi at the first opportunity possible, waited for two defenders to come to him and then played it across to Messi. And then Messi, instead of playing that ball first time, actually set it up, got a round check, really good finish. I think that's just the best example of how sublimely brilliant Barcelona is. At all of these points in that process, they had the opportunity to make the right play. And at all of those points, they made a special play instead. And it made for a beautiful counterattack and an easy goal. And maybe Arsenal could have done something to stop it. Maybe they could have been better before Luis Suarez even touched the ball. But I think that was just such a great example of how little margin of error you have against Barcelona.
Yeah, you have none. You have no margin for error. And to get undone on a counter is a little bit of cruel and unusual punishment for Arsenal on this, because they were countering so well to that point. But again, they couldn't finish those chances. And Ter Stegen made a couple nice saves. The one Giroud had early in the second half, or maybe around the 60th minute, I really thought he could have done better with that. I'm generally an Olivier Giroud backer, but that was one where he could have picked out the corner a little better on that, and Ter Stegen may not have gotten there. But other than that, I mean, their chances were kind of going wayward. And as I said, they had the wrong people over the ball. Giroud in that case. They had Ox on the chance in the late in the first half. I thought Danny Welbeck injected a lot when he came onto the pitch. But again, I'm not sure I want Danny Welbeck in front of goal against Barcelona. I mean, although he scored that winner against Leicester in an equally important game. So maybe he didn't even have time to think about that because he had just come on in that case. But it was... It was sublime, the goal, and it was also a reminder of how defensively frail Arsenal is. And this is where Arsene Wenger's got to think about the rest of the way if they're going to catch Leicester City in the Premier League and catch Spurs. They're very much third favorite in my book behind those two teams. Do you have to make that change now? Do you keep Murder Soccer in the team? Do you go to Gabriel? Do you maybe even go to Callum Chambers as a right center back? Murder Soccer is making a lot of mistakes, a lot of mistakes of age, but a lot of mistakes of judgment. And this was a player who never made poor judgment decisions in the past, but lunging into challenges, picking up red cards, not clearing the ball properly, the sorts of things that he never used to do. Murder Soccer's foot speed has always been questionable, but his football head and his football brain never was. Now, seeing some odd things out of him, it might be time to drop him. They've got Spurs in a couple of weeks, March 5th. That's a big game.
Yeah, very big game. And we highlighted that one when you were last on the podcast. You have that one being a draw at White Hart Lane based on tradition, how Tottenham hasn't quite been able to get over the hump against Arsenal, but obviously there are some factors in 2016 that could change that history. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, and this dovetails with what you were saying about Mesut Ozil, who was more quiet in this game than I think Arsenal fans would like him to be. And it goes back to something we've been saying all season, that Mesut Ozil needs to be special for Arsenal to win this title. The thing that I want to highlight here is Wenger's inability to make adjustments. Because we saw so many times in this game, Javier Mascherano cheating very early, coming out of the defense to cut off that ball to Mesut Ozil. It wasn't even that Barcelona was having to keep Sergio Busquets near Mesut Ozil. They were freeing him up to react to the play in front of him. Barcelona had tons of possession in this game, and Arsenal was backed into their defensive third most of this game. Javier Mascherano jumping in front of Mesut Ozil, maintaining possession as Arsenal was trying to get out of their half, leaving Gerard Pique isolated on Olivier Giroud, not having a weapon that could really have Barcelona pay for that tactic, and not having a tactic that can actually exploit Barcelona willing to go with one central back at different points in time and let Javier Mascherano roam forward. I thought that was very telling, because I just didn't see an adjustment for Arsene Wenger. And just on a very basic level, if you were going to let your opponents do that, if you were going to let your opponents take a central defender and mark out your number 10, you're going to have a very hard time maintaining possession, let alone actually winning one of these games.
Yeah, and there was no tactical change made, and Arsenal certainly have guys on the bench that you could make the change when, although Santi Cazorla being injured, I guess, has impacted kind of how, you could throw him in and give push Ramsey forward, wouldn't have to play Ox at all, and you can play Ramsey out wide, actually, in that case, and maybe the whole thing looks different. Mm-hmm. And the assignments are different, and Mascherano can't cheat like that if he's got Cazorla to worry about, and Ramsey might cut in from the right side and do some damage. It was also, one other performance I was not thrilled with from the Arsenal perspective was Alexis. It's against his former team. He had some flashes, but he wasn't as sharp as I thought he was a performance. I really fancied him to have a good game, a big game, because I thought he had a point to prove, and he played hard, but you're seeing the quality difference between Alexis and the guys that replaced him, right? Neymar and Suarez. It's a pretty steep drop-off.
Yeah, I would have liked them to put Alexis up at the number 9 and start playing some long balls behind the defense so Alexis can use his speed to run onto them and maybe try to outrun Gerard Piqué a little bit. But more than anything, I, like you, think Olivier Giroud is a good striker. But this is an example of where not having an elite striker that you're afraid a defense can just play a ball to, and they can not only win the ball and hold it up like Olivier Giroud can do, but then can turn and take on a man and create his own shot. I don't think Olivier Giroud is actually that good at that, and I think that's one of the reasons why Barcelona could take the risk with Mascherano. Arsenal didn't really have a guy that was going to
make
the
pay for
that.
Right, and there are guys in England who can do that even at this very moment. I mean, I think of Harry Kane. He's a guy that could. I mean, not saying that he's an elite level striker, but he could play that way.
Kane, Vardy, Aguero, teams have. Yeah. Even Diego Costa, when he's on his game, can do these things. Arsenal just doesn't have a guy like that, and to a certain extent, I think Arsenal fans have been right to ask for that guy.
Yeah, I think that Giroud has been underappreciated by some because of that. That having been said, You're looking at a match like this, and there's a clear difference. The difference makers on Barcelona are just that much better. And that's why, as much as you want to lament some of the chances that went missing, that went wanting for Arsenal, they fell to the wrong guys, and Arsenal doesn't have the right guys. Maybe Alexis is the right guy, but again, as I just said a few minutes ago, Alexis, you saw the difference in level between him and the guys that are now playing in the roles that he vacated. Neymar is playing directly in the role he vacated, but Neymar was already there before he left. Suarez really is the guy that replaced him on the team, and he's just not at that level. It's plain and simple.
Yeah, I shake my head because of this, because it. A lot of ways I feel bad for Arsenal fans, because they have been given reason for hope with players like Sanchez and Ozil and Cech coming to the club. But there is a reason why Barcelona felt comfortable letting
Cech was tremendous, though.
Yes, Cech. Yes,
Cech has won the Champions League. And keep in mind, Petr Cech has this is probably the first time Cech's lost to Barcelona, I think, in his career. With Chelsea, he never lost to him. Maybe he lost one game. I know Barcelona advanced past them the year when Iniesta got that goal.
Yeah, that was a 1-1, though.
It was a draw, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That equalized Michael Essien's goal. The goal nobody remembers that was just as good as Iniesta's, but it just came before.
Right. So the reality is Cech has been a Barca killer. Yeah. And he was again. He made some tremendous saves. He was communicating well with that back line. I just Arsenal's just not good enough. I mean, no one is. Arsenal certainly played Barcelona at home better than Real Madrid did. Yeah. They certainly played better than Bayern did last season against the same Barca team. So there's nothing to really be hang your head on. We have to give some analysis, and we have to say Ozil wasn't as good as we'd hoped he'd be. Sanchez wasn't as good as he had hoped he'd be. We'd be, and I had deluded myself into thinking Arsenal could get a result in this game and at least set up a competitive second leg, but it didn't happen, obviously. But there's really nothing more Wenger could have done other than maybe make those adjustments you talked about. And even that, without Cathola in the fully fit, without Arteta being available or an Arteta-like player, I guess he just didn't have the flexibility.
They were going up against a team that arguably has 8 of the top 15 or 16 players in the world. And so Sanchez and Ozil wouldn't necessarily like meet that standard all the time. Those two are still really great players, but when we're talking about the inability to get over the hump, look, this is a really significant hump, and no other team probably is going to get over this hump this year, just like no other team got over that hump last year. I think Arsenal fans and players have reasons to be proud of their team and be proud of themselves. I think they gave a good effort just against a remarkable team. One other game we haven't talked about yet, we'll talk about for a little bit, is the game that happened in Turin. Bayern Munich was up to a 2-0 lead in the second half, and this one Juventus came back with a 2-2 draw. Kartik, I think this showed the best and worst of both teams. It showed why both of these teams are amongst the best in Europe right now, and it also showed how both teams are pretty flawed too.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're Pep Guardiola and you're Bayern, you play Juventus off the park for 60 minutes. He should have been up 5-6-0.
Mm-hmm.
You could have put this tie to bed, missed opportunities, missed chances, and then just switched off and defensive errors. And I hate to point this out because he's been so romanticized as a keeper, but I have seen numerous distribution errors now from Neuer, both in Bundesliga play and European play over the course of the last 3 or 4 months. And I don't know. I mean, he's a great shot stopper, and he can come off his line and break up play. But I don't see those sorts of errors from the other keeper that was playing in this game. I mean, these are maybe the top two keepers in the world, along with De Gea. So two of the top three. Buffon is still in that conversation for me. He doesn't do all these fancy things that Neuer does. But as a shot stopper, as an organizer, he's still there. And I have not seen Buffon make the kind of distribution errors that Neuer did. So Neuer makes a distribution error. They're having trouble getting out of their own half after the first Juve goal, and the game completely changed. And it was asked if they switched off. Pep has got to be furious because, look, I know they have the two away goals, but this Juve team is good enough to go to Munich and win, or to get a 2-2 and get it to extra time where anything can happen. So this was as poorly as Juve had played since September in that first half, and Bayern didn't take advantage of it. And now they're up against it. I mean, I know it's very fashionable just say, oh, they have the two away goals, they're Bayern, they're going to win this tie. I'm not so sure about that. I think this is really a toss of the coin. I know ESPN has that SPI, which gives Bayern like a 70% chance of advancing based on some metric. I think it's 50-50, honestly.
Really?
It's going to be.
Wow.
Yeah, I think Juve could go. The way Juve is not going to play as poorly as they did in that first half in the second leg. I don't care that it's at the Allianz. And given what we saw when Juve raised their game, I think it's 50-50. I think they would have a shot.
Yeah, 70% feels right to me, noting that 30% is, you know, the old baseball adage, if you have 3 hits out of 10, you're a success. I mean, I think that's not exactly a rare thing for a 3 out of 10 chance to come through. I think I'm of two minds on Juventus. I agree with you that it has been 4 or 5 months since we've seen them perform this poorly. But they did perform pretty poorly over the bulk of this match, and it made me wonder if I can trust any result or any performance I see out of Serie A anymore. Has the league diminished so much that when Juventus goes on a run of 12, 13 straight wins, that there's nothing there I can trust? Because when they get back to Europe, it's just a completely and utterly different level at this point.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, the only thing that we saw from them was that they were able to beat Manchester City twice in Europe. That having been said, Manchester City won the group because they beat everybody else, and Juve dropped points against the other two teams.
Yeah, and we've said that Manchester City for most of this year has not been a good team, and we've also said that England itself is a diminished league too. So what are we really learning here? I don't know. My instincts tell me Juventus is a very good team, but I actually don't seem to have that much proof of that, except for the last 20 or 30 minutes of the game on Tuesday. And even then, I wouldn't be surprised if Juventus does the same thing they did to Real Madrid last year, ends up knocking them out. Maybe they win 1-0 at the Allianz. I also wouldn't be surprised if Bayern Munich wins 4-0 because the first hour of the match on Tuesday was just that convincing.
Right, right. And then, you know, you let Robin cut in on his left foot, he's going to score. That's what happened. I mean, this basic defensive error. Lickstadter couldn't do anything against Douglas Costa. It was awful in the first half. So, and it's Patrice Evra that let Robin, and he's played against Robin, you know, dozens of times probably by now. Robin scored a similar goal against him for Bayern against Manchester United in the Champions League six seasons ago. Remember that goal?
Yeah,
at Old Trafford.
Everybody should remember that goal. I mean, Manchester United thought they were through at that point.
Right. Yeah, and they were. I mean, they were. They had taken a 3-0 lead in that second leg. And then that goal just changed everything. And then Bayern got another goal, and they went through on away goal. So it was very much a reversal of 99, right? That 2010 tie that sent Bayern through to the final against Inter. I mean, it was just very, very difficult to see how Juventus can defend Bayern in wide areas. So I grant you that for the second leg. And maybe Coleman plays in the second leg. If Robin is injured or is slowed down by then. So, yeah, maybe Bayern do have an advantage. You've kind of talked me into
Yeah, but Bayern, you know, it goes back to something we mentioned this week, and they actually haven't been that good this year. And maybe, well, they still haven't been good for 90 minutes during 2016. Kartik, let's switch over to Europa League. Very important time for England. Italy is struggling a bit in 2016 as far as racking up coefficient points. They didn't win at all last week. This gives England a chance to build a little bit of ground in the coefficient, where next year England versus Italy is going to be a major thing after a good year for England comes off the books as far as those rankings are concerned. Now, England has a chance for Manchester United, Tottenham, and Liverpool to go through to the round of 16 in Europa League. As is, they each have some work to do. Let's start with Manchester United. They lost 2-1 last week in Denmark against Midtjylland. They, like City, are facing a quick turnaround in this one, only 2 days off before facing Arsenal on Sunday. How do you think Louis van Gaal is going to juggle those two commitments?
I don't know that he can. I mean, I saw, obviously, against Shrewsbury, he got good performances from Juan Mata and Ander Herrera. I would expect Marouane Fellaini, if he's fit, to play a role in this. Obviously, I'm not sure what Bastian Schweinsteiger is for the club, given van Gaal's comments. Now, of course, that having been said, Pep's coming in. Not Pep. I'm thinking the wrong man to decide. Some other manager will come in. And
Pep's
perhaps,
best friend.
Yeah. Well, right. Well, if it's Jose, yeah, I think he probably keeps Schweinsteiger around. Yeah. Von Hall has been making some bizarre comments, and I think he's cracked. So I could see Midtjylland getting an away goal and advancing, or maybe Manchester United are going to win 3 or 4-0. Who knows? But there's really no sense in trying to predict results with Manchester United at this point. It's a difficult one.
Well, I mean, I guess unless you're predicting wins, I mean, that doesn't make much sense. We haven't had a lot of evidence that they're capable of winning games lately. We just know that they're still a talented team. Kartik, I talked about it with Lawrence this weekend. I haven't gotten your thoughts on this. We have had another upsurge in Mourinho coverage about his potential move to Manchester United. We had the sister of an executive in Italy say that she knows that Mourinho is going to move to Manchester this year. What are your current thoughts on Jose Mourinho going to Manchester United being the yang to Pep Guardiola's Manchester City yin?
Yeah, I mean, Pep wanted to move away from La Liga partly to get away from Mourinho. So this is going to be a difficult one for him. And they're both going to be in kind of a rebuilding phase with their clubs. So it will be most interesting. That having been said, I mean, I think the young Martial is somebody that Mourinho will like if he comes into that job. De Bruyne and Sterling are players that, especially De Bruyne, players that Pep will like. Iheanacho is a player Pep will like. So it's funny because they're both going to be in kind of rebuilding jobs while we look at heading into next season, potentially Spurs as coming into the season as the favorite next year, assuming they don't have to sell players. Now, when I talk to people around the game, they tell me Spurs and Daniel Levy they will resist the temptation now because they've reached a certain level to sell the Modrics and the Bales and those level players Berbatov.
They don't have those. That's what's so brilliant about this team. They don't have those level of players.
Well, maybe that's true.
With the exception of Christian Eriksen, they don't have one player that somebody from the continent might want to come in and pluck
Real Madrid will probably want Eriksen, you would think.
Maybe. Or Bayern. Yeah, you would think so. Those are the two teams that would seem to make sense for. But even like a Harry Kane, where everybody's speculating he might go somewhere. One, I don't think Tottenham sells him within the league. Two,
right.
What team from Europe has a need for Harry Kane and will want to pay the 40 or 50 or 60 million euro fee that Spurs want? There's nobody. Everybody else has better strikers in Europe. Kane is probably not going anywhere. Probably nobody from that team is going anywhere. That's what's so great about this team.
Right. So I think Pochettino has Spurs poised as the favorite for next season, whether they win the title this season or not. But then beyond that, there's going to be wholesale rebuilding all over the league. So. Yeah. Mourinho might like his chances to get some players in and play the victim card, which he does so well, and try and rally the troops to get Manchester United to challenge Spurs for the title. The Arsenal, I think, are going to have maybe they're not at the rebuild stage yet, but they're getting there. I think if they don't win
the title this year, they're at least at the rethink stage.
Yeah. So again, I think beyond Spurs, there really isn't any team in England that looks imposing on paper. So. Mourinho will probably like going to Manchester United, and by all indications, at least the indications of people who seem to like Jose Mourinho, he will behave differently at Manchester United. It's a club esteemed in history, in tradition, in a certain etiquette. Chelsea is not that. So apparently he understands that and will behave differently. We'll see, though.
Yeah. We haven't talked too much about Midgetland, but neither of us are Midgetland experts. And I think it goes without saying, if Manchester United fall out of Europa League to Midgetland, we're in uncharted territory. So anything that we would say about the repercussions would be highly speculative. You would expect there to be some kind of at least discussion of repercussions. It would be one of the more embarrassing incidents in Manchester United's history. Let's move to London. Let's talk about what's going to happen at White Hart Lane on Thursday. Harry Kane, Moussa Dembele, both out as Tottenham welcomes Fiorentina. This one is tied 1-1 after the first leg. And based on that result and the switch of venue and the talent between these two teams, you would expect Tottenham to be favorites in this one, Kartik.
Yeah, this is a big game. Very, very big game for the league because of the coefficient. And I thought when this draw came up that maybe Spurs would give up on Europa League, considering they're in the league title race and they were still in the FA Cup. Pochettino did the opposite. He went ahead and let go of the FA Cup, played a very much a rotated reserve-like squad in the FA Cup, got eliminated by Crystal Palace, who we know has been very bad in the league, and now are in a position where they are going to have to try and advance from this tie to justify that. And as I said, head-to-head, this is a very, very big deal. Paulo Sousa coming back to London, by the way, Fiorentina manager. He has been famously depicted on the QPR documentary. Why am I blanking out on what it's called? A four-year plan when he was sacked.
He had basically a cameo in that one.
Yes, he had like all the managers in QPR that are pre-Warnock. He had a cameo like every other manager. He went on to better things at Swansea, did very well at Swansea, almost got them promoted. Made the mistake of going to Leicester, which was seen as a big money project at the time. Obviously, the big money project has paid off now for Claudio Ranieri as they sit top of the table a couple of years later. But a highly thought of manager has done a very good job with Fiorentina. And so it'll be good to see him match up with Pochettino, who I think these days is kind of considered the top manager in England, even though he wasn't considered that in Spain. I don't know if that tells you the caliber of managers in England or just that he's raised his game since coming to
the progression of a young professional maybe there. Yeah. Sousa went on to have very good results in Switzerland. And then, of course, he switched over to Italy now and he's having a very good year there. Fiorentina's in third place right now. And obviously, very good team to watch. And
for those who don't know, I know we're taking a side here, but basically, a player, Dexter Blackstock, was loaned to Nottingham Forest or sold to Nottingham Forest from QPR when Sousa had specifically requested that the ownership keep this player because he didn't have another striker. So, and then he went in the press and said, I didn't sell the player, basically. And then, and then, so he was sacked immediately.
Yeah, QPR tried to cancel his contract for leaking inside information, essentially.
Right.
Last game on the Europa League docket here, Liverpool versus Augsburg. Liverpool with a huge talent advantage here. Augsburg, we know, well, if you follow the show, you know, struggled mightily at the beginning of the Bundesliga season as they struggled group play in Europa League with the Bundesliga campaign. They have fought their way slightly clear of a relegation battle there and looking like they're going to climb towards the middle of the table, as is a healthy Liverpool, has so much more talent than Augsburg here. Switch in location here. This one is also even going into the second leg. And also, Augsburg looks like they're going to be without their leading scorer in the competition, Raul Bovadilla, who picked up an injury last week. This, to me, has the makings of a comfortable result here for Liverpool. I guess the danger here is, one, how do you balance this against the League Cup? And two, how do you not lose focus on the game at hand, given what's happening on Sunday?
Right, Bovadilla is out for Augsburg, and that makes a pretty big difference in their attacking play. They've been decent. They've gotten results. They've been gutting out results in Bundesliga. I've watched a fair amount of them recently, but I still think Liverpool's getting fit. They're getting comfortable with Klopp. They're going to win. They're a threat to win this competition. I think, obviously, the Borussia Dortmund, they've got to get through this round. But Borussia Dortmund and Spurs are the two teams that stand out as favorites in the competition. But beyond those two, Liverpool might be in the next pack of teams, believe it or not. Yeah. Manchester United is not there. They're not going to win anything this season. So whoever they draw next, if they get by Midtjylland, I'm going
to
probably get
them. I think I really agree with you, especially with a team like Napoli having to juggle a league challenge. In Serie A, they obviously have aspirations there, and the talent that Liverpool has, and then just the improvement they might seen over the last couple months. Yeah, I think I agree with you. I hadn't really considered Liverpool that much of a threat in this competition, but I think it might happen. But Kartik, before we go to break, I want to shift focus a little bit to Sunday. Nipun and I are going to break down a League Cup final in the next segment. But before we do that, I just want to get your prediction. City versus Liverpool at Wembley. Who claims the League Cup?
I think Liverpool wins because they've obviously already shown they can beat Manchester City badly this season. They've also got probably a fresher, you know, they've got this Augsburg tie. They're getting their players fit and back from injury. Manchester City has a similar injury crisis to what Liverpool had when they played Exeter City in that FA Cup tie at the beginning of January. So it's just a matter of timing. If Manchester City had played Liverpool then in a League Cup final or League Cup semifinal, they would have been the favorite. They probably would have won. I think at this point, and Pellegrini made the decision to keep Sterling on for 90 minutes and Silva on for 90 minutes and Torre on for 90 minutes against Kiev, thinking he needed the third goal, which he got. So which he got right at almost at the death. What that means is that those guys are going to have to go a second 90 minutes or maybe 120 minutes without sufficient cover. I think all of that stuff favors Liverpool. That having been said, Sergio Aguero and Yaya Toure are still two of the few real game changers in England that can just take a game by the scruff of the neck. And when Torre's motivated, he's pretty tough to stop, even at his age.
Everybody at home, in your subway cars, in your cars, let's welcome in Nipun Chopra now. Nipun, it's been a while. It's nice to talk to you again. And
The A-team.
The A-team. Mm-hmm, exactly. You can go ahead and keep calling us that. Nobody listening to our voices believes that.
Hey, if you believe in this, hashtag A-team, baby.
If you believe in this, you probably also believe in fairies. There's only one real piece of news since Sunday, and I'm not even sure if it's news yet, but on Tuesday morning out of Italy, Gazzetta dello Sport reporting that Antonio Conte and Chelsea have an agreement in principle for Conte to be named Chelsea manager for next season. Follow-up reporting during the week from English outlets hint that the negotiations are still going on, perhaps Italian media getting ahead of themselves again there. But just in general, Conte to Chelsea seems like a real possibility right now, Nipun. What's your reaction to that?
It's a good fit, I think. I'm very curious to hear what you think, but for a while there, Conte was just another one of those quote-unquote next Mourinho's. You know, we had AVB and Rodgers and a bunch of people who were being prescribed as the next Jose Mourinho. This is about 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. when Mourinho was probably hottest during that Inter run. And I think it's a good fit. I think tactically there are things that Conte does that would fit Chelsea's style. He likes to play with holding midfielders. I can see Fabregas playing in the modified Pirlo role that he had at Juventus. Matic, Obi Mikel, if they don't hire, this is of course assuming that the current personnel will be there next season, which is not far from the case with Chelsea. So in a lot of ways, it's a good fit. There's one dark mark over Conte, which is the match fixing scandal. A little bit, we can talk about that. But your thoughts? Do you think Conte is a good fit for Chelsea?
I can't get a good read on it, Nipun. I go back and forth on this.
Yeah.
The negative is that I'm not really sure how to contextualize what he did with Juventus. He obviously was very successful there. When he moved to Juventus, Juventus had just had a terrible season. It was a couple seasons after they had just come back up to Serie A. Kind of the momentum that they had from that had been spurned amid a bunch of spending that didn't really work out that well for Juventus. And he not only got them to rebound from that, but he got them winning titles on a regular basis. But I think what we've seen in the interim is that Italy hasn't exactly been the most competitive of leagues. We can add to that his experience with the Italian national team, where I think when I look at the Italian national team, he's done some good things with some very limited talent. But there is this perception that the Italian national team should still be among Europe's elites, and I don't think that they are. There's this perception that they have the talent to be among Europe's elite, something I disagree with.
And I agree. Yeah, I agree with you. I disagree with that notion as well.
Yeah, so I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, and I'm not actually sure how much of what I've seen from Conte actually translates to the Chelsea job. The things that I like is that he's youngish. He's 60. He's 60.
60. He's 40, no, he's not.
He's 46 years old. He's actually not that far removed from his playing days. He was a longtime player for Juventus. He's about a decade, a little more than a decade beyond that right now. He should be able to relate a little bit to players. But I just don't know. I don't know what to think about it. He seems to be very versatile in his tactics, at least in the setups that he uses. Yep. Plays three at the back, plays four at the back, can play a varying number of strikers. So I don't think he'll be nailed into any particular approach coming into the Chelsea squad. And maybe for a squad that kind of needs to be remade a little bit, that's probably a good thing. Nipu, maybe you can give me some context on how you're thinking about this. I just don't know how to stack him up against the other managers in the Premier League. At the same time, when City is going out and getting somebody like Pep Guardiola, I just don't know where Antonio Conte fits into that picture.
Yeah, I think Conte is definitely not in that upper echelon. He's not the first person you think of when you think of top level, well, world-class managers. I mean, I think when we did the manager review, we all agreed that the likes of Ancelotti and Guardiola and maybe Simeone and Mourinho fall in the under that category. Mm-hmm. And maybe Conte is just a level below that, where we discussed another set of managers. But you would have to say that, at least, so when I look at this Italy thing, Richard, I think he did a good job, as you said, with a limited amount of talent. I think his handling of some very combustible Italian talent, which he did pretty well, is indicative of what I think he'll find at Chelsea, which we know, Richard, the big issue at Chelsea is not that they don't have talent. It's that they have a bunch of combustible egomaniacs who run that dressing room. So from that perspective, I think
I'd actually disagree with that. I think that their talent has this year shown that it's aged enough to where they actually need some pretty significant additions to the team. I think that talent-wise, I think Mourinho just did a better job with that talent than we gave him credit for last year.
And that's also true. Again, it comes back to that man management thing, which I think Conte is good at. But I still think there's significant talent there. Don't get me wrong. I agree. I think Chelsea needs to reinvest, and there will be player turnover this summer. But I think there's still quite a good number of very good players at that club.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. We're going to talk about the Premier League here in a second, but for now, let's jump down to the Championship, which played its 33rd round of the season midweek. Among Tuesday's results, first place Hull stayed on top of the table with a 1-0 win at Ipswich, with Mohamed Diame's early second half goal handing Mick McCarthy's team their third straight loss. Second place Burnley, having played one more game than Hull, stayed within a point of the top thanks to their 1-0 win against visiting Nottingham Forest, while Middlesbrough, down in third place but with two games in hand, snapped their six-match winless run with a 3-1 victory over Cardiff, staying within 2 points of the top. Further down, Brighton continues to push for a top two place, 1 point behind Borough after their 4-0 romp at Bristol City, while Derby won their second in a row, their second since moving on from Paul Clement, with a 1-0 result Wednesday against Blackburn. The Rams stay fifth, 5 points from an automatic promotion spot, while Sheffield Wednesday holds down sixth, despite their home draw with QPR. A heads up for this weekend. On Saturday in Spain, Atletico Madrid visits Real Madrid. A resurgent rivalry on one hand, on another hand, just a fight for second place in Spain. Either way, it's Zinedine Zidane's first major test in charge of Los Blancos. In Germany, Bayern visits fellow Champions League side Wolfsburg. But Nipun, our main focus, of course, is England. 8 league matches, 1 cup final. Where should we start?
Let's do what we do every week, Richard. We'll rank these games or talk about them in the order in the ascending order, the number 9th game being the one that we consider to be the least, possibly the least enjoyable, aesthetically pleasing, whatever metric you want to use. Mm-hmm. And with that parameter, obviously, the least likely game of any that anyone should watch this week is West Brom at number 9, West Brom versus Crystal Palace. Now, as you pointed out before the game, before we start recording, this is on NBC for some inexplicable reason. You know, it's going to drive home the narrative of soccer being a boring sport. We know about West Brom. I think the big thing to look at here will be Palace will try to create using their wingers, Zaha, Bolasie, and maybe Adebayor can get involved in this game and put away a goal on a West Brom side that has been resolute but very painful and blasé to watch.
Number 8 on our list is Aston Villa's visit to Stoke City. This is a game where Stoke City clearly has the superior team and the superior talent, but we've seen Stoke City struggle when they have to play on the front foot. They've been very good in counterattacking, very good when they can have other teams create space for them. It's going to be the other way around this weekend at the Britannia. You'd expect Stoke City to get 3 points out of this one. At the same time, they're going to have to go out of their shell to do so.
Number 7 is Watford versus Bournemouth. Bournemouth have had a good record, actually, away from home recently. Watford have lost 5 out of their last 9 Premier League games. Interestingly, the last time Troy Deeney played Bournemouth at Vicarage Road, scored a hat-trick in a 6-1 win. Wow. My prediction for this game is actually a draw.
Number 6 on the list tells you how many good matches we have to watch this weekend, because Southampton versus Chelsea is a pretty good match. Southampton is playing like the best defense in the league since the new year, and Chelsea is coming off maybe their 2 best performances of the season, one of those against a third-choice City squad in the FA Cup. Still, Chelsea is playing as good as they have at any point during their title defense. Southampton still has an outside shot at a top 4 finish. They need to push on. Going to be a difficult task this weekend at St. Mary's. Very good matchup there.
Definitely. I have to say Chelsea's looking good right now. I think Hazard scoring and Costa in form, this could be an ominous game in terms of where Southampton might be on the receiving end of a hiding. Number 5, West Ham versus Sunderland. West Ham are still missing a bunch of players who are their creative players in Valencia, who's a doubt. Andy Carroll, who's perennially injured. Sakho might be injured as well. Allardyce returning to his old club. And then the big thing I think you guys mentioned maybe a couple podcasts ago was how good Mark Noble has been. I expect him to be involved and lead West Ham to a comfortable win. But I expect at least 1 red card in this game.
Number 4 is at White Hart Lane, where Swansea, trying to pull themselves out of a relegation battle, visit Tottenham Hotspur, a Tottenham team that is coming off a loss in the FA Cup to Crystal Palace. As was pointed out this weekend, Tottenham did generate a number of chances in that game. They're out playing Fiorentina on Thursday, where you'd expect that match at home. They'll continue pushing on and being one of the best teams in England since the turn of the calendar. Part of the question here is the turnaround time. They do have Friday and Saturday off, but they're still doing that quick Europa League turnaround. And a Swansea team that can keep the ball on the ground and has a reasonable amount of skill and in certain players speed in their team might be able to take advantage of any mistakes that Spurs are likely to make. At the same time, you have to think Mauricio Pochettino's team heavy favorites in this one.
Definitely. Do you know if Kane is going to play? I know he had a broken nose.
Kane is going to be out of the Fiorentina game, as well as Moussa Dembele is going to be out. So we'll have to wait and see how he reacts to that. But there is a possibility that we might see Son Heung-min up top for Spurs.
Which is interesting, right, Richard? Because then you would say that the 4 most important players in each position, obviously, Lloris is out, Vertonghen in defense is out, Dembele is out in midfield, and then Kane up top. So that's an interesting workaround that Pochettino is going to have to do there.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Number 3, Leicester City versus Norwich City. The prediction is that Leicester wins comfortably, simply because Leicester is playing out of their minds. Norwich, in my opinion, as I've said many times, a very, very poor side. What I was asking myself before I started recording, if Leicester are to get a point, what would they have to do? And what they would have to do...
Do you mean would Norwich get a point?
Sorry, yeah. If Norwich want to get a point or more, what would they have to do? And what they'd have to do was get Robbie Brady involved. Wes Houlihan scored last week. And then one of the two up top, Jerome or Mopakani, will have to score from what I expect would be maybe just one or two chances in the game. Mm-hmm. Leicester will probably run away with this one.
Whenever I watch Norwich City, it seems like the difference between how they're performing this year and how a lot of us expected them to perform is Nathan Redman. Mm. Wes Houlihan is obviously a very talented player, but he's somebody who at this point in his career, it's been covered a lot, can't play that many minutes in a week.
Right.
Nathan Redman, on the other hand, a very talented player who's ascending into the prime of his career and hasn't actually been much of a factor this season. I think a lot of people, based on what he's done in previous seasons, based on what he's done for England, maybe expected a little bit more creativity and threat from him this year. Hey, you can have years as a young player where you're just racking up the minutes and you're not actually that effective, but it's going to pay dividends down the road. I think that's what these last couple of years of Ross Barkley have been about for Everton. But Nathan Redman, if he doesn't come on, the difference between his potential and his performance might be the difference between Norwich being a first division side and a second division side next season. Nipun, let's move on to what are clearly the two biggest games on the calendar this weekend, and it shows you that we must have a cup final, that Manchester United and Arsenal are not occupying our number one spot. They're number two on this list. Manchester United is playing the day after we're recording this at home to Midtjylland. Very important game there. To be knocked out of the Europa League by Midtjylland would be a very, very embarrassing.
Yeah,
in an embarrassing season, maybe it would be appropriate. Arsenal, on the other hand, ran into a buzzsaw on Tuesday against Barcelona. They did play on Tuesday, though, as compared to Thursday, and that's, I think, where we should start. How midweek performances are going to affect each of these sides. The short-ish turnaround for Arsenal, the short turnaround for Manchester United.
Yeah, it's been interesting when you look at the way Van Gaal has dealt with training, at least this year. This wasn't true last year, is that he's given United a number of days off, just straight off, not light training, not just working on set pieces, just straight up days off after midweek games. Now, I don't think he'll be able to do that because we play tomorrow and then a huge game against Arsenal, as you point out. So. And you and Karthik maybe talked about this, how difficult it is for that turnaround from Thursday to Sunday. It's so different from Wednesday to Saturday or Tuesday to Saturday.
Yeah, Karthik talked about that a lot, especially if you're on the road. Now, Liverpool, Tottenham, and Manchester City are playing at home this week, but still, it's hard to come back on Friday and have a full training, and then you need one prep day in there to actually prep for the other team.
Well, so. United plays at Old Trafford this.
Right. Tomorrow. They all play at home.
Yeah.
So Liverpool, Tottenham, and Manchester City aren't having to do the travel thing like they did last week. Thursday, travel back Thursday night, kind of have a wasted day on Friday. But you still can't have a full training session for whatever team that you played on Thursday on Friday. They need a recovery day. And then Saturday, it gives you one day basically to prepare for the game.
And the thing is that the problem that gives up for United, Richard, is that Van Gaal has to do something special tactically to expect anything out of this game. Mm-hmm. When you look at United's injury list, right? Will Keane just got injured. He was going to be probably going to play forward, at least come off the bench. He's injured now.
So sad.
I know. Just devastated for him. He's had the worst luck with injuries.
I was saying it's more so sad that Manchester United is at the point where this player that was having trouble scoring goals for, was it Preston or Ipswich he was at? He's at Preston, right?
Yeah.
He scored like one goal in 18 games.
Well, to be fair, he scored five. 2 weeks ago in the reserve game. So
Not really sure it's fair to mention reserve game results, but it just it does speak to where Manchester United is at with their injuries and their squad depth.
So we're going to end up, Richard, with a back four. I'm not even going to go through the rest of the injuries, but we're probably going to end up with Varela, Smalling, Blint, and Borthwick Jackson apparently is now injured too. So Rojo, who just came back into training yesterday, is expected to play 20 minutes tomorrow. Might find himself starting against Arsenal. And can you imagine Rojo, who on his best day, Richard, can be found out for pace. Here's a guy who hasn't played a game in about 6 months. He's going to come up against what is on paper and realistically, almost realistically every time, a very good attacking lineup for Arsenal.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame for, I guess this is kind of breaking the fourth wall here. We're actually recording this segment before we record the one that you've already heard with me and Karthik. But one of the things that jumped out to me in the Arsenal game.
How very what's that movie out right now? Which is breaking the fourth wall? Deadpool of Us. How very Deadpool of Us.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet. But one of the things that made Barcelona so effective against Arsenal, despite having like 7 or 8 of the best 15 players in the world, was the way that they pushed Arsenal so deep in their defensive end, and then Javier Mascherano could actually come out of defense and cut off a lot of the balls coming back out to Mesut Ozil and help maintain that possession. If Manchester United starts the back four that you talked about, yeah, I'm not sure that they can learn anything from what Barcelona did and play that aggressively with one of their central defenders, because neither of those central defenders, maybe Blind a little bit, Smalling obviously is very athletic, but neither of those central defenders can have the same influence in midfield and read the game as well as Javier Mascherano. Either way, it just seems to really limit Van Gaal's option.
It really does. I think Dali Blind, one of the things that has gone unnoticed is how well he does read the game. I think he might be, other than maybe one or two defenders, he's actually a midfielder, but his ability to read the game is, I think, exceptional. I think him and Smalling have been one of the success stories of this season. I know that people talked about him a lot at the start of the season, but the point is that everyone, including myself, wrote off this defensive partnership at the start of the season, and they've exceeded anyone's expectations. So for me, that isn't really the problem.
Well, no, I think there are different ways you can read the game as a defender. Sure. Like, there's reading the game and adjusting, going backwards to your own goal, tracking runners, that type of thing. And then there's reading the game in front of you as far as cutting, knowing when to come out of defense, having the relationship with your partner, knowing that they're going to cover, and being able to actually win those balls and making the right decision. Because when you're going to leave that space behind you, you have to be almost 100% sure you're going to win that ball. And I think that Dali Blind does read the game really well. I think he's a very, very intelligent player. I just don't know if he has the same instincts as Javier Mascherano, which is not, I don't want to make that sound like a slight, because Javier Mascherano has developed into an excellent central defender.
Absolutely. I don't think it was a slight. I think for what it's worth, I think Blind can do a job. For me, the danger area is more in the positions around Smalling and Blind, in the left back position, in the right back position, in the holding midfielder position, where we have been, you know, in spite of how good Carrick is, who was on the bench in the FA Cup game against Shrewsbury, in spite of how good Herrera can be some days, I think there's a huge gap between the defense and the midfield, and the fact that our midfielders are exceptionally slow in terms of tracking back. So that is an area that Arsenal has excelled at, making the runs from deep, the likes of Ozil, Sanchez, who's been in and out of form a little bit, Joel Clambill / Oxlade-Chamberlain, whoever's playing on the other side.
Yeah.
So those are areas that really trouble me as a Manchester United supporter. Let me say this, Richard. It's fascinating to me, the history of this tie, because when I started watching soccer, United and Arsenal were completely, at par with each other. They played, they were obviously competing against each other all the time. And then there was a while where Arsenal was irrelevant, and United basically had the beating of Arsenal every single time they played each other. And now it's come to the point in the last 2 or 3 years, at least for me, that I don't see a way that United will beat Arsenal. And it just, I love the, I guess I don't love it right now, but I appreciate the cyclical nature of this once great rivalry.
Yeah, I guess I just don't see a way Manchester United beats Arsenal, except for the inherent variability of soccer.
Right.
The one thing that I ask myself coming into this game is something that we've harped on all year with Arsenal, and we reiterated on the weekend show, Arsenal's tendency to be hyper effective in bursts. And until proven otherwise, I gotta believe that that's kind of how Arsenal is gonna win this game, that there will be a 2 to 20 minute stretch of this match where Arsenal is the best team in England and Manchester United can't stop them. I keep going back Manchester United's likely setup and say, is there a way that they could stop them? Is there some way here where Manchester United can have their players, their talent level rise to this occasion? I just don't see it as great as Manchester United's defensive record has been this year, a lot of that has been built off of goal prevention through possession. And if Arsenal does keep the ball as much as they're capable of keeping the ball, or choose to keep the ball as much as they're capable of keeping the ball, even if that possession is only in that 20-minute stretch, I'm just not sure Manchester United has the players to stop them.
I mean, you've essentially described the game at the Emirates, is what you just did.
Oh.
For 20 minutes, Arsenal destroyed Man United. They scored 3 goals in 25 minutes, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, United looked comfortable in possession, looked like they might score a couple of goals. But realistically, the game was over. And that's exactly what Arsenal need to do, especially away from home. If they can have a productive 20, 30 minutes, they're totally, I mean, that's all one would hope for.
As we talked about with Kartik this weekend, Manchester United is one of the few teams that is going to play each of the top four teams between now and the end of the season. Yeah. If Arsenal can get 3 road points on Manchester United, that can prove to be a very valuable advantage over the other title contenders. Let's move out of the league and let's talk about the big matchup.
Hang on, what's your prediction? You said Arsenal winning, right?
I think
I'm going to go with a draw because I'm a United supporter, but Arsenal's going to win.
Yeah, I think it could be a score. I think we could see a scoreless draw, maybe a 1-1, but I'm thinking this is more going to be like a 3-1 for Arsenal.
Oof. Probably.
Liverpool versus Manchester City at Wembley. It's the match that'll cap off the weekend. It is the first major piece of silverware on the English calendar, the League Cup final. Manchester City got by Everton to get to this final. Liverpool got by Stoke City. For Manchester City, it could be another League Cup for Manuel Pellegrini. For Liverpool, it could be Jurgen Klopp's first major success in England. Nipun, coming up to this weekend, as this tournament unfolded, I saw this as a major opportunity for Liverpool, mostly because Manchester City has not played that well during these last couple of months. On Wednesday in Kiev, 3-1 victory, rather impressive performance, gives me some indication that their team is coming to life, but we get back to this idea of a quick turnaround plus a long piece of travel for Manchester City. I guess the key to this game for me is how that recovery affects a very thin Manchester City squad at this point.
Yeah, and you compound that with the fact that Liverpool didn't play FA Cup weekend because they were knocked out. So they've had a really long extended break here. They will play the UEFA Cup game, but the amount of rest they've had has far exceeded City, who had to rotate heavily on Saturday or Sunday, was it, in the FA Cup?
Yeah, on Sunday at Stamford Bridge. And then they started pretty much their strongest team in Kiev. They do have some depth at the fullback position, so we could see Zabaleta and Kolarov come in. They didn't play against Dinamo. Other than that, there aren't a lot of options unless Iheanacho comes in and Manuel Pellegrini switches up his formation. All the other major players are going to play again.
I mean, this is, I find this interesting. We'll come back to the player and personnel in a second. I find it interesting because if Pellegrini wins this game or gets, you know, a good result, even if it's a draw coming in late from a late equalizer, suddenly people will start remembering how much we love Pellegrini. Because for a few days now, everyone's talking, including Manchester City supporters, have been talking about how Pellegrini has disrespected the FA Cup and all that. Garbage, which is absolute garbage, first of all.
Yeah.
So I would love, in that sense, for City to have another good performance against Liverpool. Because if you're a City supporter and you had 3 games, one against Chelsea away in the FA Cup, then an away trip to Kiev, and then an away trip to Anfield, and you had a draw, a win, and a loss from that, you'd say, well done.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, you can't have a draw because it's actually, I guess it would be 2 wins, right? Because it's like cup finals.
But also, if you were to rank those priorities in terms of, okay, you have a League Cup final.
Right.
You have a Champions League round of 16 tie. And then you have an FA Cup 5th round match on the road.
And
you have to play those games over 8 days. So prioritize those. And I find it difficult to believe that anybody would prioritize them differently than Pellegrini. Now, what are the complaints saying? Do you really want to push Sergio Aguero into 3 matches in 8 days? Does that sound like a good idea with Sergio Aguero, with Vincent Kompany, his injury history, David Silva, Yaya Toure? What are the real options here? Why are people getting upset at Manuel Pellegrini?
I really don't get it. I think it's this desire to knock someone down when he's already on the ground. Because obviously Pellegrini, with Guardiola coming in, every poor result will be framed as, oh, the players already know that he's on his way out, so they don't support him and stuff like that. So it's very easy to dismiss him as such. Whereas, I think any manager in the world, any rational football supporter would have done exactly what Pellegrini did. And think about this. If they had got a somewhat decent result, people would have said, oh, look at him trying to bring through youth. But just because they got smashed by Chelsea, the narrative completely changed. And it's extremely frustrating.
I think maybe there's some anger that Pellegrini seemed to give up on the tie before even the kickoff happened. It's almost as if he was trying to prove a point to the FA through this. And I can get that a little bit, but you got to give him some leeway. All right, let's talk about the game again here. To me, Liverpool's result at the Etihad, sixth or seventh game in Jurgen Klopp's tenure, I can't remember, but I think we all remember the actual game. Liverpool just tore Manchester City apart, and a lot of it was the pressure that Liverpool's forwards put on Manchester City's back line. In addition to Felipe Coutinho just stripping Bakary Sagna of the ball to create a goal, what we saw was the pressing that Jurgen Klopp has instilled, giving Nicolas Otamendi, and in that game, Eyalakim Mangala, a ton of problems. So if you start from that as a premise that Liverpool is going to play that way and it can give certain elements of the Manchester City team trouble, I think the questions we have to ask are how much having Vincent Kompany healthy, how much potentially having Pablo Zabaleta on the right instead of Bakary Sagna can make a difference in what was a one-sided game.
Yeah, I think we have to remember that that game at the Etihad, I think at that point, Liverpool had not, if I remember correctly, they had not really won under Klopp. I think they had just been a ton of draws, draw after draw under Klopp. And I think at that point, they almost had a feeling of nothing to lose. Whereas there's a sense of pressure here in this Liverpool team. So I don't see it playing out the way it did at the Etihad. Was it at the Etihad or was it Anfield?
No, it was at the Etihad.
Okay. So yeah, I don't see it playing out that one-sided. Definitely not in this cup final. But the things you mentioned as far as City having the propensity to struggle against the press has shown up not only in that game, but in other games subsequently. Mm-hmm. Leicester City is another example of that. We discussed that before. So I don't know. I'm torn in terms of how the game will play out. But I think some of the things that are different now is the incorporation of Sturridge as well. Because in that game, Sturridge was not fit. So with Sturridge on the would probably be on the pitch unless he has another inexplicable injury, you have to wonder if that same kind of press, that same setup, because in that game, again, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a false nine playing. So you can do the press much better with a false nine than you can do with someone like Sturridge.
Yeah, it was Firmino, Lallana, and Coutinho starting in those three spots, and then you had Milner doing that kind of hybrid position. All right, now my turn to ask the question of you. Prediction for this one.
Prediction for this one, I think City wins.
Really?
And, I think City will win.
Give me a score.
Give you a score? Oh, it's going to be, I'm going to say 2-1. Hmm. Simply because I can see the big guys who have been in this position before coming through for City. There's not a lot of winning experience at Liverpool. I guess because of that, you'll have one Touré get over the other Touré. And by the way, this will be the last time either of these Tourés will probably be representing their respective clubs in a high-profile game.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah, I think a lot of the prediction here comes down to how much you believe in Jurgen Klopp. As much as he is somebody that has a distinct style that he likes to play and instill in his teams, he is somebody that is seen as a motivator, somebody that can inspire players and instill a sense of pride in them. And if you are a big fan of Jurgen Klopp, you're probably going to find a way to predict Liverpool wins this one. 2-1
Liverpool.
Are you?
2-1 Liverpool?
2-1 Liverpool, oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, everybody, we are going to be coming back to you on Sunday after the League Cup final to talk about that match as well as the 8 matches in the Premier League. But until then, for everybody at World Soccer Talk, I'm Richard Farley. Nipun?
George.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com.